session number 30304.
Said Ryanair Real 2. So how many opportunities did you have to fly before for the outbreak of war?
As to the actual number of flights, I'm afraid I can't say. Unfortunately, it will all be in my logbook, but I lost my logbook on a move. I think it's from when we moved up from Exeter to this area. But certainly I remember that it was a total flying time of 2 hours and possibly three flights, something like that. I seem to dimly remember going up for familiarization, controls, turns, banks and so on. The second time, a takeoff, obviously with the instructor with his hand very near the control column or the joystick, whichever you prefer, and then for the third time trying a landing with under his control, of course. But that's about all I remember of that.
Can I just ask you a little bit about those various things? So a familiarisation flight like that, what does that entail? Is that just to get used to the controls, or is it to get you used to the location?
No, mainly controls, first of all. At least that's... I think you can't generalise about this. I found when I did quite a bit of instructing myself later that the approach... is best left, the initial approach is best left to the instructor to decide, having sized up his pupil and perhaps taken him up once or twice. But normally I would expect the pupil to do what I did normally if I was going to fly a different aircraft. I would want time to go and sit in the cockpit, as I suppose they do nowadays in the various, I can't think of the word, these setups.
Simulator,
yeah. Yes. Because you need to feel the instruments as well as see them. And, for instance, pop your head out of the window and see what the stick is doing when you pull it back to the elevator and so on. So I think that it would... The early flights, both there and when we... moved to an elementary flying training school, the same would apply there, that it was familiarization within the aircraft or for the aircraft, about the aircraft first. There was really no point in, to me anyway, no point in allowing the attention of the trainee pilot to be diverted to other things such as the steeple on the church and that kind of thing, when it's, first of all, you're going to be at some time in your career in a cockpit where you need to know where everything is. You may not have any environment other than that. So it's very important.
And at this time, were you flying in Tiger Moths?
Yeah.
At Barton. Mm-hmm. What were your initial impressions of it as an aircraft?
Oh, it's beautiful. Beautiful. We were very lucky, Manchester VR chaps, because when we were moving, Well, after mobilisation, which of course took place on the day following war broke out, we had a fortnight, well, up to the 18th, I remember, of September, leave. And then when we had to move from there, we were posted to elementary flying training school I'm getting ahead of myself. We still have to go through the process known as ITW, Initial Training Wing, where there are no aircraft, and in my case, where there are lots of colleges and etc., because it was Cambridge. I think that the same approach to the initial flying training stages would be the same, were the same, when we did start flying.
In many respects as well, I think you were probably lucky in the fact that you actually flew pre-war, because I know a lot of people who were in the Volunteer Reserve didn't actually have the opportunity over that period of time.
Yes.
So within those three flights, had you got a good feel, do you think, for what was going to be involved in the training process?
Yes. That also, of course, meant that having grown accustomed to tiger moths, just to see them fluttering around and so on, it gave you a feeling you want to be there, be one of them. And when we were on the train moving from the town centre, having been mobilised down to Cambridge Initial Training Wing, there was a lot of talk about the fact that training would be done either on a tiger moth or a magister, Miles Magister. And we knew that the airfield at Cambridge was using magisters, so we were hoping that we weren't going to Cambridge for ITW and for EFTS. And it wasn't until later that we knew we were going to be moved to an EFTS which was using tiger moths, and we were all very grateful for that, because it was such a beautiful aircraft. You got a real sense. There was a poem written by a chap who later became an Air Vice Marshal about the joy of flying. And he was right.
With the tiger moth, do you actually get that sensation of being of flying? Because I know in certain aircraft there's less of that feel.
Oh, yeah.
Do you have the feel and sensation of the elements around you and that you're in?
I certainly did, yes, because in the first winter of the war, which was when I was going through EFTS, excuse me. It was it was a very hard winter, and we were, of course, in open cockpit, we were very glad of what was known as the Sidcot suit, and that was, you know, the usual complete flying suit and helmets. There was a little windscreen, no more than about 4 inches deep, at the front of the cockpit on the tiger moth. It didn't shield much of the slipstream, if you're going to start flying, I don't think it happens nowadays, I don't know, but I think that if you're going to start flying, you want to fly an open cockpit aircraft. So we did, but to say the Magister, of course, was also an open cockpit, and it didn't have, it was a monoplane, so you would think that you feel more open in it than in a tiger moth. But when I flew a Magister, which was later on in 1942, I think, because, you know, you could fly various types on various stations, when I flew the Magister, although it did the job, it got me from A to B and took a pal of mine on leave, it was nothing like flying a Tiger Moth in the sense of being one with the elements.
If I can take you back slightly with that, how had the process of mobilisation taken place? Because I know, obviously you're aware that wars about to occur, but how did you hear the declaration of war, and how did you get mobilised?
Well, we knew that once war was declared and that we would be mobilised as quickly as possible, and I'm amazed at the speed with which the staff at I don't know what the total role of RAF bodies there was at the time, but there must have been quite a lot from those that I saw, and I was amazed at the speed at which it was done. We knew we could expect, we had to report the day after, I think I'm right in saying that, the day after war was declared, because war was declared on a Sunday, of course, so that it, you know, it's the Monday we all had to report. That in itself took quite a time, and we'd be told that there would be a further summons to follow as soon as possible. And it wasn't until the 18th that the form came saying that I had to report to the centre at such and such a time on the 18th of September. And then from there we were issued with the kit bags and something else, other small stuff. And marched down to what was then London Road Station in Manchester, now Piccadilly in Manchester, and from there down to Cambridge. And when we arrived in Cambridge, we were met and taken to the memorial buildings of Clare College on Queen's Road. Three with a palliasse each to a room. It's quite pleasant. Lovely. It's a lovely place to be.
Was there, I mean, you've obviously, the group had come down from Manchester. Were there other groups coming in from other towns?
Oh, yes, yes. Yes. We reckoned that the group with which I was associated would be about 100 strong. And very quickly we came into contact with lads from other VR centres. Whether the mobilisation movement was total from Manchester or not, I don't know. I suppose what I'm really saying is that they may have disposed of us in batches. There may have been others to follow, because I don't recollect seeing more than about 100 VR chaps in a unit in Cambridge. So
at that time, though, was Cambridge, were the colleges becoming a centre for initial training wings? There wasn't just the college that you were in, people were in other colleges, would that be right?
Oh yes, yes. It wasn't just Clare Court. I don't know which others, but the RAF had already taken over parts. None of the colleges were completely taken over. I think it's a very reasonable thing to do, because as you know, universities have their own links with military units, I don't know whether there was. I think there was. I'm pretty sure there would be with the local airfield marshals being so close to Cambridge. A link between the university and some form of setup like that, so that these people, undergraduates presumably, although it would include graduates as well, I suppose, depending on what their commitment had been, they would be leaving. In those 18 days, whilst we were sort of being sorted out in Manchester, chaps who joined the Army Reserve or whatever from university would be leaving and leaving these vacancies. So it seemed to be a very good idea to fill them with. Everything was ready made, the buildings, the means of life, as it were. And it was the first initial training wing to be set up there.
What were your sleeping arrangements like?
Well, just three on the floor. but it was okay. I remember on the door of our, there was the name of one of the famous Cambridge Eight. I don't know when, would it be that? Sometime early that year, probably. Well, it would be, wouldn't it? It'd been the April of 1939, and his name was on the door, so we felt quite privileged.
What was the first thing that happened to you? Obviously, you got your accommodation sorted out when you arrived. But what was the first thing to happen? Did you have to report somewhere for lectures, or was there a drill, or?
No, the first thing, of course, to get some grub, which we were on one side of Queen's Road. Do you know Cambridge there? Clare College is next to Trinity Hall. Trinity, is it?
King's,
yes. It's in that area. If you're going down that way, down Queen's Road, most of the colleges are on the right, but the Memorial Court was then simply extra accommodation for undergraduates for Clare College. And they had their own dining room, which was only small, I don't know, it may be that there were more people leaving, more undergrads who had military ties. I don't mean worn. they had more accommodation, it seemed, in Trinity. And we dined at one table within this majestic dining hall. And that was the first thing we did. When we got off the train late afternoon sometime, that was our first pleasant and surprising Cambridge. Although, of course, we were not exactly welcomed by some of the high table people, but... I suppose they got used to it.
So what was the next stage? What occurred the next day?
Well, we were introduced to Warrant Officer Tynant, whose name, of course, is easily corrupted to Tyrant. And he was given the job of smartening us up and teaching us how to drill. We did this on the backs. What can I ask for more? Who can ask for more? Drilling on the backs. Sorry. 100 sprogs, as the name soon became attached. in our various disguises, sports jackets and flannels, and one poor warrant officer in charge of us. In charge of us for most of the time. He was the chap who took us through the streets in as tidy a bunch as possible to one or two various, I suppose you'd call them really adjuncts to the colleges or parts of the colleges. I remember one of those steep stepped lecture theatres where we had a lecture from a medical officer about the usual things. St John's College, part of St John's, was set up as the medical centre. And we had to go there for jabs of various kinds. Including inoculation, and my inoculation came up quite a lot and became very swollen, so I had to go. I was off duty for quite a time, about 3 days, I think, altogether, because it was looking rather nasty, with a walk through Cambridge from wherever we happened to be, probably from a meal to go to have this thing attended to twice a day, walking to John's. We just then had got used to drilling in three ranks when this was amended throughout the whole service units. I think in every type of navy, army, or whatever, to four, drilling in four ranks. So that took quite a bit of a bit of fun in it. I remember because I happened to be the tallest of the gang, and that I had the easiest job in this because I was always a marker. You see, tallest on the right, shortest on the left. So I had an easy job just there. Just sort of stood there, and all the others were sort of getting. And he was a rather authoritative warrant officer. We didn't like him at first. He was very, very keen on haircuts and that sort of thing. But eventually we realized that he was doing his job and getting us into a really good sort of unit. And, you know, we would then march through Cambridge, colours flying sort of thing, you know, really feeling fairly proud.
Did everybody take to the drill easily, or were the people who didn't?
Well, we had our bits of fun, you know. There was one occasion, I remember, where the tyrant bawled out. Changing step was one of the difficult things for a group as large as 100 to do it fairly smartly. And I remember on one occasion, he gave the order, Sergeant Hall. Well, he didn't say Hall, he said, Sergeant Hall, change step. And everybody changed step apart from Sergeant Hall. Because we noticed that he was doing this, you see, and so it was more or less arranged. And then he found this chap out of step, and he tore him off a strip, and said, we'll do it again. And so there were other holes besides Henry, my particular friend. He was called Henry, incidentally, after the famous band leader, Henry Hall. His real name was Jack. Anyway, he was not the only one called Hall in this group of 100. And the next time we did it, there were three of them still out of step. Oh, my goodness, he'd sort of tore his hair at this. And then we realized, you know, that we'd had enough of this. And I think he realized it was a bit of good fun in the end. And that seemed to be the sort of turning point where we became one.
Is that an interesting process that you go through? Because at first, do you actually realise that, even though you've been in the Volunteer Reserve, you said there was a sense of belonging, yeah, but to actually function as almost a unit, is there a point where that occurs?
Yeah.
Were you having lectures at this time?
Yes. Yes, they were a little better designated than those we'd had at IT that where am I? At the Volunteer Reserve Centre. We had some specialists, obviously from the university staff. They could find some who would be free at a convenient time or had a lightened load or something of that kind. So they really were spot on, many of them, and obviously map reading and plans and that kind of thing. Magnetic variation, meteorology, they were all useful lectures then. And I think they did extremely well in the very short time that these things could be prepared and accommodated.
And am I right in thinking at that stage you were all pilots under training?
Oh, yes.
In that group?
Yes.
You've been designated at that right from...
Yes, a pilot's UT. Well, it was part of the... Perhaps I should have mentioned this earlier. It was part of the contract, if you like, between the before the war, between the reservist and the RAF, that you would be enlisted as a leading aircraftman, which was equivalent to a lance corporal in the army. And would you would retain that rank until being mobilized or until you got your wings if you were in the RAF proper. But the contract also was, I say contract because I can't think of a better word at the moment, but it was that if wartime service, excuse me, should be necessary, you became a sergeant on the outbreak of war. So we were all sergeant pilots under training. Sergeant pilots UT.